From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're on the road in Park City, Utah at the Sundance Film Festival.
When someone asked me about violence, I just find it incredible. What it means is that the person who's asking that question has absolutely no idea what black people have gone through, what black people have experienced in this country since the time the first black person was kidnapped from the shores of Africa.
Angela Davis, the rare archival footage, is part of a new documentary called The Black Power Mixtape, 1967 to 1975. The trove of film was found in the basement of Swedish public television. It features some of the leading figures of the Black Power movement, including Stokely Carmichael, Huey P. Newton, and others. Also, rare footage of Dr. Martin Luther King with Harry Belafonte meeting with the King of Sweden. We'll speak with the co-producer of the film, actor and activist Danny Glover.
Chrissy, does it belong to? You know, and that's the fundamental question here. And once we begin to tackle that and struggle against that, we have a chance, you know, because the powers that be are going to find every way to undermine it, to subvert it.
But first, the Palestine Papers. Newly released documents show Palestinian negotiators secretly agreed to give up large tracts of West Bank land and most of East Jerusalem in peace talks with the Israeli government. It's being called the biggest leak of confidential documents in the history of the Middle East conflict. We'll speak with Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're in Park City, Utah. The attorney for alleged Army whistleblower Bradley Manning's accusing the military of intensifying its harsh treatment of Manning as he remains behind bars. The lawyer, David Combs, says Manning was placed on a stricter suicide watch last week, despite psychiatric reviews showing he's not a suicide risk and should even be taken off a less restrictive prevention of injury watch. According to Combs, the military revoked Manning's lone hour of exercise and stripped him of all his clothing except his underwear. Manning was ultimately returned to prevention of injury status after Combs complained. The military is also cracking down on his visitors. On Sunday, Manning's friend David House and progressive blogger James Hampshire were both detained and prevented from visiting Manning at the Quantico military base in Virginia. They'd brought with them a 42,000 signature petition criticizing Manning's prison conditions. House has publicly alleged Manning's mental and physical health has declined under 23-hour-a-day solitary confinement. The pair were detained for 2 hours and released only after Manning's allotted visitation period expired. Former Chicago Police Commander John Burge has been sentenced to 4.5 years in prison for obstruction of justice and lying about torturing prisoners into making confessions. Burge was convicted in June following longtime accusations of overseeing the systematic torture of more than 100 African-American men. The police department fired him in 1993 for mistreatment of a suspect, but did not press charges. Burge was ultimately indicted in 2007, not for the torture he oversaw, but for lying about it. After the verdict, victims of torture under Burge, as well as prisoners' families members, denounced the sentence as a slap on the wrist.
This is a complete injustice. 4.5 years where men have spent 20 and 30 years in prison is outrageous.
Burge gets 4 years, 5 years, and he goes home. That's not right. My brother spent 16 years on death row for something he didn't do.
John Burge will begin serving his jail sentence in March. President Obama has publicly introduced General Electric CEO Jeffrey Immelt as his new top economic advisor. Immelt will head the newly formed President's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, which takes the place of the Economic Recovery Advisory Board led by Paul Volcker. On Friday, Obama said Immelt would drive the administration's stated goal of creating jobs.
Our job is to do everything we can to ensure that businesses can take root and folks can find good jobs, and America is leading the global competition that will determine our success in the 21st century. And so now, to help fulfill this new mission, I'm assembling a new group of business leaders and outside advisors. And I am so proud and pleased that Jeff has agreed to chair this panel, my Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, because we think GE has something to teach businesses all across America.
I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag. Born to a throne, stronger than Rome, but violent prone, poor people's own. But it's my home, all I have known, where I got grown, streets we would roam. Out of the darkness, I came the farthest, among the hardest, survival. Learn from these streets, it can be bleak, accept no defeat, surrender, retreat. So we struggling, fighting to eat, and we wondering, when we'll be free. So we patiently wait for that fateful day. It's not far away, but for now we say, when I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag. And then it goes back, and then it goes back, and then it goes back, and then it goes. When I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag. And then it goes back, and then it goes back, and then it goes back. Oh, oh, oh. So many wars, settled in scores, bringing us.
GE CEO Jeffrey Immelt's appointment has come under scrutiny on multiple fronts. He'll retain his position at the helm of GE, creating a potential conflict of interest. As one of the nation's largest corporations, GE has a variety of business and issues before the federal government, including media mergers, military sales, environmental cleanup, and a $16.1 billion bailout in 2008. And while Obama has touted Immelt's mission to create jobs, the United Electrical Workers Union says GE has closed 29 plants in the United States in the past 2 years, laying off around 3,000 workers. Arizona Congressmember Gabrielle Giffords was transferred to a Houston rehabilitation facility Friday, less than 2 weeks after she was critically wounded in the Tucson shooting rampage. Giffords' new doctor, Gerard Francisco of Memorial Hermann Hospital, reported on her progress.
She surprised us. She did not need as much assistance as we had anticipated. There were still people holding on to her, as was described previously, but she's activating her muscles even more than what I had anticipated. At one point, her leg was dangling in the bed, and we asked her to bring her leg up. After a couple of seconds, she brought the left leg up without any further delay.
Newly released documents show Palestinian negotiators have agreed to give up large tracts of West Bank land in peace talks with the Israeli government. The disclosure is among many contained in what's being called the Palestine Papers, over 1,700 files from Israeli-Palestinian negotiations dating back to 1999. The news network Al Jazeera began publishing details of the papers on Sunday. Minutes from a 2008 meeting indicate Palestinian negotiators offered to allow Israel's annexation of almost all of East Jerusalem. Al Jazeera says forthcoming documents will reveal new details about compromises the Palestinian Authority was prepared to make on refugees and the right of return, as well as on the PA's security cooperation with Israel and its correspondence on the UN inquiry into the late 2008 attack on the Gaza Strip. Palestinian Authority officials have challenged the document's veracity. Chief negotiator Saab Erekat called them, quote, a pack of lies. The document's release comes as an Israeli government inquiry has absolved its political leadership and military of any wrongdoing in the deadly attack on a Gaza-bound aid flotilla last year. 9 people were killed, including a U.S. citizen, when Israeli troops stormed the Mavi Marmara ship on May 31st. Inquiry chair Jacob Turkel unveiled the panel's decision.
The commission's conclusion is that the imposition of the naval blockade over the Gaza Strip was lawful and complies with international law. considering Israel's security concerns and its efforts to fulfill humanitarian obligations. This commission's conclusion is that the entire action taken by Israel on May 31, 2010, to enforce the naval blockade, despite a small number of incidents in which force was used, and their details are still not fully clear, were legal and in accordance with the international law.
We'll have more on the flotilla inquiry and the Palestine Papers after headlines. We'll be speaking with Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi. Thousands of people have rallied in northwestern Pakistan to protest ongoing U.S. drone attacks that have killed scores of civilians. On Sunday, demonstrators in the city of Peshawar blocked a main road and held a vigil to mourn the victims of drone bombings. According to Agence France-Presse, U.S. drone attacks doubled in the North Waziristan region last year. Over 100 drone strikes killed more than 670 people. At least 13 people were killed in three recent attacks. Protests continue in Tunisia against the interim government formed after the overthrow of President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali earlier this month. Hundreds of people defied a curfew in the capital of Tunis on Sunday to camp outside the office of interim Prime Minister Mohamed Ghannouchi. Opposition activists want him and other officials who served under Ben Ali to resign. The interim government has pledged to release political prisoners and has placed two top Ben Ali advisors under house arrest. In a new milestone for the Tunisian opposition, thousands of police officers, army service members, and government workers rallied in the capital Saturday in a show of solidarity with the protests that ousted Ben Ali.
I'm very happy with Tunisia today. Tunisia, which is teaching the world the meaning of democracy. And the police here are not police. The police are our brothers, and we are united.
More protests have erupted across the Middle East in the aftermath of the Tunisia uprising. On Saturday, thousands of people rallied in Yemen to demand the resignation of President Ali Abdullah Saleh. The protest was confined to the campus of the University of Sana'a, avoiding a street confrontation with Yemeni forces. Meanwhile, in Algeria, protesters clashed with government forces in a bold defiance of a ban on public gatherings. Opposition leaders say around 40 people were wounded. Former Haitian dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier has appealed for public sympathy amidst corruption charges and human rights investigations since his recent return to Haiti. Known as Baby Doc, Duvalier returned to Haiti this month, 25 years after a popular uprising forced him into exile. On Friday, Duvalier said he feels sadness for those he says are recognized as victims of his government.
I take this opportunity to express again, one more time, my deepest sadness towards my compatriots who are recognized as being victims under my government.
While Duvalier claims he's come back to help Haiti rebuild, critics say he's making a last-ditch attempt to recoup some $6 million in a frozen Swiss bank account. A Swedish law passed in response to Duvalier's long-term attempt to withdraw the funds kicks in next month. Duvalier would only be able to evade it by entering and leaving Haiti without prosecution. That's a Swiss law. A Philadelphia abortion doctor has been arrested on charges of murder and performing illegal abortions that caused the deaths of seven babies and a patient. Dr. Kermit Gosnell was arrested last week along with his wife and eight unlicensed employees. A grand jury report accuses Gosnell of regularly and illegally delivering live babies in the third trimester, then murdering the newborns by severing their spinal cords with scissors. Gosnell and his staff are also accused of killing a pregnant mother by providing her with too much anesthesia. The grand jury report also singles out Pennsylvania health and medical regulators for ignoring complaints against the clinic dating back to 1993. State officials are said to have deliberately avoided enforcement of laws mandating that abortion clinics provide the same level of care as other medical providers. Gosnell is believed to have earned at least $1.8 million a year for his practice, mostly in payments from low-income women of color. The U.S. death penalty system has been dealt a major setback following a drug company's decision to no longer produce an anesthetic used in most states' lethal injections. On Friday, the Illinois-based Hospira said it would comply with an Italian government request that it not produce sodium thiopental at its Milan area plant. Italy does not practice capital punishment. The decision will force states to find an alternative drug and potentially modify regulations, a process that could prove both lengthy and expensive. And in media news, MSNBC host Keith Olbermann has left the network after 8 years. On Friday, Olbermann ended his nightly countdown broadcast with the announcement it would be his last. Although he did not specify a reason, Olbermann's departure came just after the Justice Department gave final approval to media giant Comcast's takeover of MSNBC's parent company, NBC Universal. Keith Olbermann was briefly suspended in November after it was revealed that he had donated money to three Democratic candidates, including Arizona Congressmember Gabrielle Giffords. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Park City, Utah. Newly released documents show Palestinian negotiators secretly agreed to give up large tracts of West Bank land in peace talks with the Israeli government. The disclosure is among many contained in what's being called the Palestine Papers, thousands of pages of confidential Palestinian records covering more than a decade of negotiations with Israel. It's being described as the biggest leak of confidential documents in the history of the Middle East conflict. The more than 1,700 files cover a period from 1999 to 2010. They were obtained by the TV news network Al Jazeera, which began publishing details of the documents on Sunday. Among the leaked papers, the offers relating to East Jerusalem are the most controversial. Minutes from a 2008 meeting indicate Palestinian negotiators offered to allow Israel's annexation of all but one of the settlements built illegally in occupied East Jerusalem without receiving any concessions in return. Chief Palestinian negotiator Saab Erekat quoted as saying, "We are offering you the biggest Jerusalem in Jewish history," using the Hebrew word for Jerusalem. But Israel apparently rejected the offer. Then Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni told the Palestinians, quote, "We do not like this suggestion because it does not meet our demands, and probably it was not easy for you to think about it, but I really appreciate it." Al Jazeera says forthcoming documents reveal new details about compromises the Palestinian Authority prepared to make on refugees and the return, as well as the UK's security cooperation with Israel and its correspondent NATO attack on the Gaza Strip. Officials challenged the veracity. For more, I'm joined now. He's the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University, the Department of History, and the author of several books, including Sowing Crisis, American Dominance and the Cold War in the Middle East, and Iron Cage, the Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Khalidi. Can you respond to the trove of documents that Al Jazeera...
Well, this was the first of what is supposed to be 4 days of revelations of documents by Al Jazeera and by the British paper The Guardian. The concentration in the first group seems to have been on Jerusalem, and the revelations are quite striking. The most important, I think, is the degree to which not only Palestinian negotiators were forthcoming, but the degree to which the Israelis were unwilling to accept concessions. It seriously casts into doubt the idea that Israel would accept anything but complete capitulation by the Palestinians to absolutely everything they're demanding on every front. We've heard about Jerusalem. There is presumably more to come. But another thing that comes out very strikingly from these documents is the degree to which the United States is twisting the arm of the Palestinians, the degree to which American diplomats, whether Hillary Rodham Clinton or Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice during the previous administration, are unsympathetic to the Palestinians and are in cahoots, in Aaron David Miller's words, are lawyers for Israel. It's actually worse than Miller, who was involved in the negotiations for many years, says from these documents.
Now, what about Saab Erekat saying this is all a pack of lies?
Well, both Al Jazeera and The Guardian have claimed that they have very carefully investigated the provenance of these documents. I think time will tell. I have no way of knowing. I think none of us have any way of knowing exactly where they come from. We are told that many of them come from the negotiation support unit. Watching Al Jazeera last night, it was clear to me that they look like they come from within the Palestinian negotiating team in terms of letterhead and so forth. Whether there could be forgeries among them, nobody knows. But many of these things, I think, fit the outlines of what we all knew, partly because people on the Israeli side, on the Palestinian side, and the American side have said a great deal about the negotiations from 1999, certainly through 2008. And the broad lines of these major concessions made by the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, the broad lines of the intransigence of Israel in simply refusing to accept concessions, or rather banking concessions, and then saying, well, now we want more. It's not enough for you to give up every single settlement in Jerusalem except one. We want all of them. It's not enough for you to say that you would make concessions inside the old city of Jerusalem. We want more as far as the Haram al-Sharif is concerned. The detail is what is the most striking, and I seriously doubt that in some cases somebody went to the trouble of forging things that showed exactly how this process took place. So I think that we're going to find that most of these documents probably are genuine.
Professor Khalidi, what most struck you in these documents about the communities that the PA was willing to give up?
Well, in Jerusalem, there are several issues. One is that the United States, which claims to support the position which is undergirded by international law, that all settlement across the Green Line, all settlement in occupied territories is illegal, is a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, is basically pushing the Palestinians to make concessions on that principle, arguing that you will not have a deal. I believe this was Secretary Rice. You will not have a deal unless you give up, I think they were talking about Ma'adi Adomim, a settlement to the east of Jerusalem, which, in fact, apparently the Palestinians accepted to give up. The point here is this is Palestinian land, private property in many cases, across the Green Line in territory illegally occupied by Israel and into which Israel has been exporting its population in violation, again, of the Fourth Geneva Convention. That the United States should support a position in violation of international law might not be terribly shocking, but to see it laid out in this form, I think, calls into question, at the very least, not just the good faith of the American negotiators and of the United States in this process, but the good sense of anyone who would rely on the United States as an interlocutor or an intermediary with Israel. Other things that were discussed, such as the Haram al-Sharif, might be very shocking to people in the Arab and Muslim worlds, because it appears that the Palestinian Authority has agreed to some kind of shared sovereignty over one of the three most holy sites in Islam, a property that is a piece of territory that's not just sacred, but is also the property of the Islamic Waqf in Jerusalem, and have accepted that a committee of international actors, none of whom are particularly sympathetic to the Palestinians, Saudi Arabia, Britain, the United States, and so forth, Egypt and so forth, should somehow have control over this most holy site in all of Palestine to Muslims. This is pretty shocking.
And the other report that we have just heard, the Israeli government being cleared in the attack on the Mavi Marmara, the Gaza aid flotilla, last May 31st, Professor Khalidi.
Well, I mean, this is entirely expected. An Israeli government-appointed commission, rather than an international commission, a dependent commission appointed by the government rather than independent of the Israeli government, has come to a conclusion whitewashing the government that appointed it. I don't see why anybody should be surprised. It essentially hewed to exactly the lines of the Israeli propaganda offensive that was launched the very day that this ship was attacked, which argued that the blockade of essential supplies from Gaza, which is a violation of international humanitarian law, is legal, that everything that the Israeli forces that attacked this ship did, including killing nine Turkish including one Turkish-American citizen, was legal. Essentially, this thing was written, or could have been written, insofar as what we've seen so far of it, by the same people who were in charge of Israeli spin management. It's taken them a number of months to produce it, but the Israeli government spokesman could easily have written this. Almost every key argument in this commission report was put forward by the Israeli government spokesman at the outset of this affair.
Professor Khalidi, I want to thank you for being with us. Professor Rashid Khalidi is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University.
Pleasure.
He's written a number of books, including Sowing Crisis, American Dominance in the Cold War in the Middle East, and Iron Cage, the Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, well, we'll talk about the Sundance Film Festival here in Park City, Utah, and a remarkable new documentary that's come out. It's called Black Power Mixtape. We'll speak with Danny Glover. Stay with us.
I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag. Born to a throne, stronger than Rome, but violent prone, poor people's own. But it's my home, all I have known, where I got grown, streets we would roam. Out of the darkness, I came the farthest, among the hardest survival. Learn from these streets, it can be bleak, accept no defeat, surrender retreat. So we struggling, fighting to eat, and we wondering, when we'll be free, so we patiently wait for that fateful day. It's not far away, but for now we say, when I get
Kanan singing Waving Flag. He was singing in our studios in New York, but he was also singing here this weekend in Park City, Utah, at the Sundance Film Festival. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and that's where we're broadcasting from today. Yes, Park City, Utah, home of the Sundance Film Festival, the nation's largest festival for independent cinema. We're at Sundance this week to feature independent voices from here in the United States and around the world. More than 200 films and documentaries are being screened and premiered here at Sundance. One of this year's selection that's creating a lot of buzz is a documentary called The Black Power Mixtape. The film features rare archival footage shot between 1967 and 1975, including some of the leading figures of the Black Power movement in the United States, like Stokely Carmichael, Bobby Seale, Huey P. Newton, Angela Davis, Eldridge Cleaver. The footage was shot by two Swedish journalists and was discovered in the basement of Swedish public television 30 years later. Well, the renowned actor and activist Danny Glover co-produced the Black Power Mixtape. We flew in on Friday night. It was the first film we saw. Yesterday, I had a chance to sit down with Danny Glover to talk about the film. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Danny Glover.
Thank you.
So, Danny, tell us about this film.
Well, it's extraordinary. It's almost when you think about something like that's facing that we're dealing with now in terms of WikiLeaks, you know, and how information is uncovered. This film is about information or documentary filmmakers and interviews with members of people involved in the Black Power movement.
Now, this was found in the basement?
It's found in the basement of Swedish television. It had been aired only once as a series. And these incredibly rich interviews, just from 1967 to 1975, rich interviews of men and women who were involved in the Black Power movement, but also Swedish television coming to the United States and assessing themselves and interviewing people about the movement. So you would have an interview, a young sister at the Black Panther Party office in New York who talks about the revolution, you know, or you would have a free breakfast for children program, or you have all this rare footage of Bobby Seale's in somewhere in Europe. And so this is what this is about. So it's a compilation of all these interviews, all these documentary films that were done, all this rich archival information about the Black Power movement.
Let's play a clip of Stokely Carmichael.
Now, let us begin with the modern period of, I guess we could start with 1956 for our generation. This was the beginning of the rise of Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. King decided that in Montgomery, Alabama, black people had to pay the same prices on the buses as did white people, but we had to sit in the back. And we could only sit in the back if every available seat was taken by a white person. If a white person was standing, a black person could not sit. So Dr. King and his associates got together and said, "This is inhuman. We will boycott your bus system." Now understand what a boycott is. A boycott is a passive act. It is the most passive political act that anyone can commit, a boycott. Because what the boycott was doing was simply saying, "We will not ride your buses." No sort of antagonism. He was not even verbally violent. He was peaceful. Dr. King's policy was that nonviolence would achieve the gains for black people in the United States. His major assumption was that if you are nonviolent, if you suffer, your opponent will see your suffering and will be moved to change his heart. That's very good. He only made one fallacious assumption. In order for nonviolence to work, your opponent must have a conscience. The United States has none. Has none.
That was Stokely Carmichael.
Yes.
In this film, Black Power Mixtape. A rare footage of Stokely Carmichael, who later came to be known as Kwame Ture, going to Sweden.
Yes.
And talking about, well, perhaps the differences between him and Dr. King, talking about the importance of action.
Yes, yeah. Well, one of the things that, I mean, is you, this is very interesting. So we're talking about 1967, so much has happened within the last 4 years since the passage of the Voters' Rights Act, the riots in Watts, the riots in Detroit, the riots in Newark. And here's Stokely Carmichael. It so happens that I first met Stokely Carmichael in 1967 when I was a student at San Francisco State. San Francisco State was very unique in the sense that a number of the members of SNCC who now decided were going back to school, came to San Francisco and resettled in San Francisco. So Stokely, Ralph Featherstone, H. Rathbone were out at San Francisco State on a regular basis. And so to hear him talk about really what was at 1967 the beginning of his own transition, his own movement from certainly the nonviolence, we had to split in SNCC by that time. We had the removal of white members of SNCC, and all those things were happening at this particular time. And he begins to announce his new path, respectful of King, and I say respectful of King, very respectful of King, as they all were, you know. Remember, it was King and Harry Belafonte who were who initiated the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, put up the resources for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and not only that, gave it life. So here he is, here's the prodigal son breaking away at this particular moment. And certainly, King had been to Sweden. King had traveled to Scandinavian countries to raise money for the movement, which is something that Harry prompted him to do as well. Harry Belafonte prompted him to do.
And, you know, of course, Dr. King had won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964, but the footage in Black Power Mixtape of Dr. King, the King of Sweden, raising money for him, and Harry Belafonte in Sweden together.
Yes. It's quite remarkable because it was Harry's suggestion that that they go to Sweden to raise money. Harry, and certainly when he first met King in 1957, Harry, one of the most popular artists in the world at the particular time, was going to use his influence in the service of Dr. King. And certainly he had very strong connections with Sweden and other Scandinavian countries as well. So you hear, this is an incredible moment, you know, at this is something that people don't know about often, you know?
And now you, at this time, as you said, San Francisco State, people have heard a lot about Columbia and the student strikes, but the first big shutdown of a university is your own, and you were one of the leaders of it.
Well, yes, San Francisco State, 1968. And a part of this was, we're all moving in some sort of way. The BSU, when I came to San Francisco State in 1966, it was beginning to make its own transition, you know. And why this film was important for me was the fact that it is also my moment or my transition as well. I had been raised, had been born and raised through the civil rights movement, and now as the Black Power movement emerged, we began to assume that. In fact, we had invited Amiri Baraka out to San Francisco State in the spring of 1967. So San Francisco State,
the poet, and we started becoming
the Black Art movement as well. So here we have the Black Power movement. As we identified by Stokely and the Black Panther Party, et cetera, and you had students who were involved as well, and myself and others. And the strike came out of that. The strike came was an aggressive move by the Black Student Union, and we were fortunate to get allies in terms of the Asian Student Association and Hispanic Student Association, and also progressive white students that made it successful.
You were fighting for Black Studies at San Francisco State just recently in Tucson, right at the same time of the horrendous shooting, actually. Headline in the paper that day about how they were shutting down
ethnic studies.
But you guys really started the activism for it.
We're still, it's 41 years old, the ethnic studies program. And what was unique is the first ethnic studies program, and the only one in any major university in the country. But interesting enough, the first time that I saw Huey P. Newton and had any idea what who the Black Panther Party was in 1966, when he came to the Black House and was reading poetry at the Black House. Huey P. Newton, that's some footage we should have had, reading poetry at the Black House. And at the Black House, Ed Bullins lived, Eldridge Cleaver lived at the Black House. There were two people who lived at the Black House. So there was, you could see this, and now we're looking, certainly looking back in retrospect, but you could see this emerging movement happening around really, what I believe was extraordinary moments of, as I said before, redefining and reimagining democracy, organizing, using those skills. Stokely was an organizer. Those members of STIX were organizing. So the Black Power movement was about extending that whole sense of organizing and community organizing.
So Danny Glover, is President Obama, or was, a community organizer in the South Side of Chicago. But he's taken a very different path.
Well, you make choices, certainly. I come out of community service and community development as well. You know, I worked for the Model Cities Program and the Office of Community Development
in
San Francisco.
I
was evaluation specialist and program manager in the Model Cities program from 1972 to 1978, and so through 1977 rather. And certainly, if you were able to, and this was a very key moment, because this also, as I think about it right now, it also is along the same lines, the parallels what's happening in the film. That there was an extraordinary level of grassroots democracy happening in communities like the Mission District in San Francisco and the Baby Hunters Point District in San Francisco. It's extraordinary. And certainly it was fueled, of course, by, I think, the sense of organizing that came out of the Civil Rights Movement, and I think also was translated into the Black Power Movement, the sense of organizing, this sense of empowerment that people could be the architects for change. And this was happening in all over the country. So when you look at Black Power mixtape, you're able to kind of reflect on a moment and understand the very core values of that moment, you know? Yeah, I mean, it was James Brown who at the same time came out and said, I'm black and I'm proud at the same time. So all these particular, this particular energy was happening. And certainly for them to be able to capture this, be able to, the Swedes be able to capture it, and looking from the outside in was a critical part of this. They were able to see this from the outside. And ask very, sometimes very innocent questions. That's certainly that interview, that question response by Angela to violence was extraordinary.
Let's go to that clip.
Yeah, but the question is more, how do you get there? Do you get there by confrontation, violence?
Oh, is that the question you were asking?
Yeah.
You ask me, you know, whether I approve of violence. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all. Whether I approve of guns. I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. Some very, very good friends of mine were killed by bombs, bombs that were planted by racists. I remember from the time I was very small, I remember the sounds of bombs exploding across the street, our house shaking. I remember my father having to have guns at his disposal at all times because of the fact that at any moment we might expect to be attacked. The man who was at that time in complete control of the city government, his name was Bull Connor, would often get on the radio and make statements like, niggers have moved into a white neighborhood, we better expect some bloodshed tonight. And sure enough, there would be bloodshed. After the four young girls who lived, one of them lived next door to me. I was very good friends with the sister of another one. My sister was very good friends with all three of them. My mother taught one of them in her class. My mother, in fact, when the bombing occurred, one of the mothers of one of the young girls called my mother and said, can you take me down to the church to pick up Carol? We heard about the bombing, and I don't have my car. And they went down, and what did they find? They found limbs and heads strewn all over the place. And then after that, in my neighborhood, all of the men organized themselves into an armed patrol. They had to take their guns and patrol our community every night because they did not want that to happen again. I mean, that's why when someone asked me about violence, I just find it incredible. What it means is that the person who's asking that question has absolutely no idea what black people have gone through, what black people have experienced in this country since the time the first black person was kidnapped from the shores of Africa.
That's Angela Davis back 40 years ago. In tape that was found in the basement of Swedish public television that has just been made into a remarkable film called Black Power Mixtape. In fact, her face with her famous afro is the poster of Black Power Mixtape. Yeah. Talk about this point that she has raised about how you raise the issue of violence.
Well, Danny Glover. It's very interesting because Let's go back just a step back and think about all these young students, the Bob Moseses, the Fannie Lou Hamers, the Diane Nashes, and Stokely Carmichael, and all these people had gone through extreme periods of violence in the South, from the integration of lunch counters to the burning and bombing of buses and the freedom riots, and even as they organized, had been beaten, jailed. I mean, it's not uncommon. And when we look at the murder of the three civil rights workers, Sworn and Goodman and Cheney, they're all not uncommon to face extraordinary, extreme terrorism and violence. And to be able to kind of now, with that, as young people assume another kind of position and understand violence in a different kind of way and reflect on that violence in a different kind of way.
It was terrorism.
It was terrorism. It was terrorism. I went and talked with Bob Moses, and he said, when you talk about terrorism, I experienced that. By the people that I work with in the South, trying to register them to vote, they experienced terrorism on a daily basis, historic terrorism. So when we think about that violence, and Angela so brilliantly points it out, that those girls who died in that church were friends of hers, friends of her sisters, lived next door to her. Their mother was a teacher, one of their teachers and everything else.
It is amazing to think. Angela Davis, yeah. Yes, friends of the little girls in the Birmingham church.
Yeah.
Condoleezza Rice, Denise McNair, one of the four children. She was friends with
absolutely.
Condoleezza Rice and Angela Davis, coming from that same yeah. environment.
It's the same environment. Then there's Connie Rice.
Yes.
Connie
yes.
Rice in L.A. came from that same environment. It's one of the great civil rights lawyers in the country, too, you know. That moment, how she characterizes violence and understanding violence. And think about that violence now in relationship to what is happening in Tucson. You know, even though we know that this young man is deranged in some way, this side that drove him to that act with the kind of vitriol, the kind of nasty, just villainous violence that is happening. The violence that happened even during town hall meetings during the healthcare crisis, the healthcare debate and everything, all this kind of violence. And then you take again that, the wars, King talks about that, how that violence comes home to haunt us.
Actor Danny Glover is the co-producer of the film that is premiered here at the Sundance Film Festival called The Black Power Mixtape. We'll come back to our conversation with him. We also speak with him about Haiti. Stay with us. And I'm proud. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah, as we return to my interview with the actor, the activist, co-producer of the Black Power mixtape, Danny Glover. So here we are at Sundance Film Festival, which is a celebration of independent films. Yeah. Talk about the importance of independent films.
This is one of the great... And for me, after all the blockbusters and everything, this is one of the great moments, I believe, in my career, to be able to kind of support the independent film, independent thinking. And certainly, if you take the whole genre of independent film, and I'm using the word genre, but if you take independent films, and they invariably have some influence on the industry anyway. Their independent film is where the real work that actors get a chance to do, where and this is what Sundance is so brilliant about, documentary films, you know, and documentaries and everything. It's so brilliant with this work about that, supporting the idea of documentaries. And when it does that, documentaries are our place and our way of establishing our relationship to what is happening to us. You know, this is only where there's some sort of context in which we can look at what has happened to us, have opinions on it, disagree with it, discuss it, and have a discourse about it, and how perhaps whether the documentary is about climate, whether the documents about healthcare, whatever they are, perhaps have some chance of understanding what the core issues are.
Certainly the film that you've co-produced, this film, Black Power Mixtape, is about movements 40 years ago. And the question is, well, another of the people here, the big films here, is about Harry Belafonte, and
yes.
He is here. And he is raising this question. He said that he feels like he has failed now as he looks back, whether there will be a new generation of activists following what has been accomplished over the decades as he walked with King and his activism, aside from his artistry and his music. How do you feel about that?
I don't sense that we, of course, we have a 20-year span, and I don't think, and there's so much work that still, that has to be done. But I don't, I have no sense of failure. I'm an eternal optimist as well, you know? And I believe that as Paul Robeson said, each generation makes its own history. They make their own history. And I think that this generation that now is gonna make their history. They're gonna have to respond to the crisis, whether it's the climate crisis, or whether it's the financial crisis, the crisis of poverty in the world, the crisis of the inequity in the world. They're gonna have to deal with that, you know? And they're gonna have to listen outside of the framework that they, and the constructs that they often have really dictated their lives or structured their lives and everything. They're gonna have to do that. And understand that, well, we can be here forcing that issue, talking about that, and talking about what the question is that if we're gonna talk about democracy, what is democracy? And as I said the other night, whose democracy does it belong to? You know, and that's the fundamental question here. And once we begin to tackle that and struggle against that, we have a chance, you know, because the powers that be are gonna find every way to undermine it, to subvert it, to stop our voices, to cut off our resources, and find out a way they can do that. But the question is that we have to believe that we can do this and continue to do this.
Before we end, I want to talk about one of the great crises of today, and it's Haiti, a country that is very close to your heart. You've been making a movie about Haiti for a long time. You visited President Aristide last February in South Africa, who was forced out. We've seen the horrendous earthquake and the effects of that, over 300,000 people killed, 1 million displaced. Now this cholera outbreak.
Yeah.
And now we see baby Doc Duvalier, a man responsible for the deaths of I don't know how many thousands of people, the dictator of Haiti, who followed his father, Papa Doc Duvalier, the dictator before him, return when Aristide has not been able to. What are your thoughts?
It certainly is painful, you know. I like Frederick Douglass, often refer to myself as a Haitian at heart. And it's unacceptable that President Aristide is not there with his people. It's unacceptable that the State Department can say to us that there is no history, or there's no future for President Aristide.
Let's be clear. P.J. Crowley, the State Department spokesperson, sends out in a Twitter message, he tweets that Aristide is the past, we have to look to the future in Haiti.
Yes.
You were talking about whose democracy.
Whose democracy?
Maybe we can extend it to Haiti.
You know, this country, these people have been under siege for more than 200 years. After the moment after its independence, it's been under siege. And let's not lie about it in every way, in every administration from that time on, from Jefferson to Madison to Clinton to Bush, all of them, every single one of them has done something to undermine Haiti's ability to stand on its own feet. These people are so resilient. They are incredible. They're organizing now. They're organizing in the midst of this chaos, in the midst of cholera, in the midst of the earthquake, in the midst of the lack of functioning government. They're organizing. You know what I'm saying? That every single president, every single administration has been responsible for what's happened. And every one of them. Yet we don't know that. We don't know any of that. We don't have any of that information right now. But right now, you're going to tell me that he is the past, that he has no place and no future in Haiti is unacceptable. It's unacceptable that baby doc has returned to Haiti. That's unacceptable, and we have to say that's unacceptable. It's unacceptable to sanction of these flawed elections as the United States continues to pressure various countries, pressure the OAS and pressure everyone in order to accept these. It's unacceptable, and we have to. we're going to have to, wherever we find, they're standing up for themselves. When they knock down the fences and refuse to be denied the right to vote during an election of Proval, they made a statement. They want their country back. They want their sovereignty back. They want their independence back. That's what the Haitian people want. And this is speaking from a Haitian at heart.
And what is it you think the U.S. finds so? Why will the U.S. not allow Aristide to return? Was the U.S. involved in the coup against him 1991 to 1994?
And the other coup in 2004.
In the coup in 2004, where they sent him off to the Central African Republic into exile with his wife, Mildred Aristide, and then he ends up in exile in South Africa, continually saying he wants to return. What is it the U.S. has against this democratically elected leader of Haiti?
Well, I don't know what respect the United States has for democracy anyway, and for people's right for self-determination anyway. I don't know really if they have that. I think it's part of an ideal. But it was part of an ideal. You know, we know our own history. It's part of an ideal. The Bill of Rights came out of not from the fathers of the Republic. It came from people demanding something more than that piece of paper. So, yeah. What it is that they must at every point in time undermine the possibilities of democracy in Haiti, and Aristide represents that. And now you can say whatever you want about Aristide, the fact that he was elected, but in every way, Haiti represents something to the hemisphere. Haiti becoming a true democracy, a functioning democracy, represents something beyond that. Every single country in that hemisphere connects its relationship, its independence, its own sense of sovereignty, its own sense of nationhood to Haiti.
I know you have to leave. We just have 2 minutes. But the power of film is the power of storytelling.
Yes.
You have been focused on Haiti in terms of film by wanting to tell the story of Toussaint Louverture. And as we wrap up, I was wondering if, in a nutshell, you could tell us that story and why it has grabbed you for so many years as a story you want to pass on to future generations.
Well, it's my story. It's a story Frederick Douglass did in 1893 at the Chicago Fair that we owe so much to Haiti. Jose Marti, the great a Cuban revolution, said we owe so much to Haiti. We owe so much to Haiti, first of all. But it's an extraordinary story, and the only story of its kind ever in the history of human, that we have written human history, that these slaves revolted and challenged the empire. At the outset of the translation, the new translation, a new construct of capitalism and liberal democracies, here's this country, this small country, these people who, at that particular point, stand up and say, it applies to us. That's what they said. It applies to them. They were defining democracy in a different way than even the fathers of democracy in this country were. Even the fathers of the rights of man in France were. They were defining democracy. That's what makes it special. It challenges us. Struggle never concedes upon demand. Frederick Douglass, and that struggle, whatever it was, the demand for independence, demand for sovereignty, is still within the people, the Haitian people's heart.
Danny Glover, actor and producer. He co-produced with Jocelyn Barnes' Black Power mixtape, directed by Göran Ugo Olsen. That does it for our show. If you'd like a copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. We'll be at the Sundance Film Festival all week, interviewing Harry Belafonte, Robert Redford in these next 2 days. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, from the producer, Amate, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Honey Masood, Robbie Karen, Renee Feltz, John Hamilton, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Nikella Hugh Grand, Jessel Noor, and to our Sundance crew, Yodivio Barrios, Mike Scholes, Richard Lavelle, Jim Lemon, Dennis Moynihan, Brenda Murad, and our thoughts are with Mike Burke and the funeral of his mother today. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.